My name is Ethan, and I was 15 in the summer of 2021. I was one of the older kids who attended Camp Lennox in Beckett, Massachusetts. My parents sent me there to get away from the noise of Boston for a while, and roast marshmallows in the New England wilderness. Minus the lockdowns from the year before, I had been coming here since 2018, and since I was the oldest attendee that summer, I became a de facto trustee. However, that summer, things will play out a little differently. Something that I would like to make clear is that this story is 100% true and can be verified by a simple Google search. Also, please forgive me if I get a bit carried away with trips down memory lane. After what happened, I have never returned to that place. And being 4 years removed, I can look back and say that I really enjoyed being there. And it's unfortunate that things ended the way they did. But like my father always says, life isn't a fairy tale with happy endings. I remember that it was the night we were doing rope burn, a big tradition at Camp Lennox. The ritual was simple. We had to build a fire high enough to burn through a rope strung between two poles. The team with the fastest blaze won bragging rights and a pizza. I was on the blue team, and our counselor, Jake, was hyping us up.
"Let's be legendary tonight,"
he always used to say. I was teamed up with two other campers, Sam and Riley. We set off to gather firewood from the edge of the forest behind the camp. Nothing unusual. We had done this 100 times before on nights when we were just building fires for roasting marshmallows. So we trudged through the trees with our flashlights, looking for dry sticks. For those of you who spend a lot of time outdoors and may have experienced a thing or two in the woods, know that the forest has a way of telling you that something is off. A strange stillness came over the forest. It was very noticeable to me. We were maybe 50 yards in, kicking through the underbrush, when Riley stopped in his tracks and looked back at us.
"Ugh. Do you guys smell that?"
he asked. He was ahead of us, so it wasn't long before I caught a whiff. It was the unmistakable stench of decomposition. Jake, holding his nose, said,
"Ugh, probably just a dead animal."
It was the logical conclusion to come to, so we kept moving. But the knot in my stomach tightened as we moved further in. I just somehow knew that we were going to discover something seriously messed up out here. Soon, my flashlight caught something. There was a figure slumped against a tree, half hidden by ferns from my vantage point. I froze once I realized it was a human. The others didn't seem to notice.
"Guys,"
I said, my voice barely above a whisper. My comrades swung their lights over to where mine was. And that's when we saw the full picture. It was the body of a man, curled up at the base of an oak, his clothes dirty and torn. His skin was grayish, bloated, and melting away. The smell hit us like a tsunami, and Riley gagged, stumbling back. Sam just stared, his flashlight shaking in his hand. Jake cursed under his breath, and stepped in front of us, like he could shield us from what we had already seen.
"Stay back,"
Jake said, his voice sharp now.
"Don't touch anything."
He fumbled for his walkie-talkie and radioed the head counselor.
"Come in. This is Jake. We found a body in the woods. Send help, now. You boys head back to camp, and don't say anything about this to the others. We don't want everyone to panic."
I led Riley and Sam back to the main camp. We sat at a table in the mess hall, whispering to each other.
"Was that real? Was that fucking real?"
Sam asked. Riley just stared at his hands, like he had a newfound appreciation for not being a melting corpse. I don't think it truly sank in for me until we got back to camp, that we had discovered a dead body in the forest. My mind kept replaying the way the man's head was tilted, like a zombie taking a nap against a tree. The police eventually came and cordoned off the area. The rope burn was obviously canceled that night, and the staff did their best to keep things normal the following day. We played capture the flag and had s'mores by the lake, but it wasn't the same. Sam had broken the silence, and the rest of the campers were whispering in their bunks at night, making up stories about how there was a serial killer in the forest. I didn't join in because I had my own problems to deal with, like how every time I closed my eyes, I would see that body against the tree. Jake checked on us the following night. His usual goofy demeanor was gone.
"You guys okay?"
he asked. I nodded, even though I wasn't. I don't think any of us were. We'd seen something that we weren't supposed to. Something that didn't fit in with the usual upbeat environment of Camp Lennox. We didn't talk much about it after that. Not even with each other. When my parents eventually picked me up, I did my best to assure them that I was fine. But looking back, I think I was just depressed, because I would never view Camp Lennox in the same light ever again. This place was once a childhood sanctuary in my mind, and was now tainted by the stench of a rotting corpse. The identity of the man in the woods was never publicly disclosed, but the police believed that it was a 35-year-old man who died by suicide. I was 13 in the summer of 1999, living in Oklahoma City. One night, I was at a sleepover at my friend Lila's house. It was our end of summer sleepover, a tradition we had kept since second grade. Except this time we were joined by a girl named Emma. Emma's parents were good friends with Lila's parents, and this was my first time meeting her, but we got along fine. Soon, the time came to tell scary stories in our little makeshift tent we had set up in the living room. We made it a game, passing around a flashlight and placing it under our chins while we told our stories. Lila and I recycled the last year's tales, only tweaking certain details from the year before, which we teased each other about. When Emma's turn came, she sat up and asked if it was okay to turn off the flashlight while telling her story. We agreed.
My aunt came over one day and told this story to my mom in our living room. They didn't know I was playing in the upstairs hallway and could hear every word.
Lila and I were instantly intrigued, huddling closer together.
A long time ago, my aunt was a camp counselor for the Girl Scouts. One morning after an outdoor camping trip, she was walking to the showers when she saw a sleeping bag lying on the trail. It was out of place, and she thought that maybe some of the girls were playing a prank. But when she got closer, she saw a young girl inside the sleeping bag. Her face was pale, her eyes open, staring at nothing. As soon as she saw her, my aunt knew that the girl was dead. That's when she saw two more sleeping bags nearby, crumpled up like trash. She ran to the nearest one and unzipped it, only to find another girl, curled up and not moving. The third one was the same. Three little girls found dead in the forest.
My breath caught. Lila's smirk was gone, her eyes wide. "Were they murdered?" she asked. Emma nodded.
"Strangled, bruised up, like they had been beaten. There was a red flashlight on one of the bodies with tape over the lens. Inside their tent was a bloody shoe print and a smeared handprint that was too big to be the girl's."
I was legitimately terrified. I pulled my blanket up and squeezed closer to Lila.
"Your aunt really saw all that?"
I asked, half hoping Emma would laugh and say the whole thing was made up. But she just shrugged.
"She told my mom she still dreams about those girls, seeing their dead faces staring up at her. The camp closed after that, and you want to know something else? They never caught the guy. Some say he's still out there, lurking somewhere in those woods."
Lila tried to laugh it off, but I could tell she was freaked out as well. The stories we told were nowhere close to this level of fucked up. We eventually moved on to talking about boys and music. But Emma's story haunted me. It was so graphic, so detailed for a preteen girl to just make up. I barely slept that night, jumping at every creak in Lila's house, imagining someone was lurking outside. 7 years later, in 2006, I was a college freshman back home for Thanksgiving. Lila and I hadn't seen each other since we graduated high school, so I drove over to her house the day before Thanksgiving. After some small talk and catching up, she dropped a bomb on me. "Do you remember that really messed up story Emma told us during that sleepover?" Truth be told, I had been thinking about that story ever since I got back into town.
"Yeah, why?"
"You're not gonna believe this, but it wasn't a made-up story. It actually happened."
"What?"
That story always bothered me because it seemed so real. I did some research in my spare time at my school's library. In 1977, three Girl Scouts were found dead in their sleeping bags at Camp Scott. Their names were Lori Farmer, Michelle Guzet, and Denise Milner. The counselor who discovered them was Carla Wilhite, Emma's aunt. My stomach dropped. For years, we thought Emma was just a good storyteller trying to impress us that night, but she had been telling the truth. Her aunt was the one who discovered the bodies of those three girls in 1977. At the time, there was an escaped convict named Jean Leroy Hart, who was suspected to be the one who committed the murders. He was arrested and faced a criminal trial back in the 70s, but was acquitted by a jury due to lack of evidence. It wouldn't be until 2022 that DNA testing revealed that he was likely the perpetrator, but by then, he had been dead for over 40 years. I was thinking of a good way to end this story, and considering that even the DNA testing was never able to definitively prove that Hart was the monster in the woods that night, and the very real possibility that someone else may have been involved, I can think of no better way to end things than by quoting Emma's own words.
"They never caught the guy. Some say he's still out there, lurking somewhere in those woods."
It has been 31 years total since I've worked as a counselor at Camp Valley Way. I've spent 20 of those years trying to forget about what I saw and lying to myself and to others about what I know happened. It came to a point where I succeeded in fooling myself and pushed the experience to a hidden place in my mind. But 20 years after that fateful day on the lake, I would discover the truth. I started working when I was 15, and I spent my summers at Camp Valley Way. The camp was nestled in the foothills of the Appalachians, between two mountains with a natural lake in the center, its water stained with a murky southern clay. I worked as a swim instructor and lifeguard. Each week, a new set of campers traveled from across the state to experience the outdoors. I still remember the exact day it happened. It was a Tuesday, the fifth week of camp, the hottest day of that summer, and just before the 4th of July. That week was known as Rich Week to the counselors, since many of the wealthier parents left their children here while they took off for holiday. This would come right after Orphan Week, which was when the Clarkstown Orphanage, the largest in the state, traveled to camp free of charge because the camp was government funded. Every year, the local residents would come by at the end of the week, and children were often adopted. I remember that a girl in my class found a new home with some local farmers, and I remember seeing Ellie wave from the cab of the pickup truck she was riding in as she started her new life with her foster family. In my off time, I would help the other counselors patch up sails under the water sports canopy. Logan, the head counselor, who was about 5 years older than me, was sitting at one of the picnic tables, his small eyes scanning the lake, He kept his hair in a tight buzz cut, revealing a scar around the back of his head. And when he spoke, it was a deep southern drawl.
Mike, watch what you're doing.
He saw that I had skipped a stitch in the sail.
I only got two eyes, and there's too much going on for me to watch everyone today.
Got it, I said, and put my head down. Logan kept a tight watch on his crew, but now his focus was on the lake. Ed and Ted, twin counselors with one brain between them, were teaching a beginner swimming course off the shore. Those two always made Logan uneasy, and earned a spot on his mental list of instructors who were likely to screw up next. So when Ed, the smarter of the two, came sprinting up from the lakeside, Logan was ready. Ed opened his mouth, words wheezing in between each breath, with his wet hair plastered over one of his eyes.
We're missing one. One camper. Can't find him in the water. Friends don't know where he is.
Without hesitation, Logan's whistle shrieked through the campground, startling campers and counselors alike.
Everyone out of the water now! All lifeguards report to the dock.
His deep voice caused adrenaline to rush through me as we ran to the water. I was the first to dive in, followed by the other lifeguards. I was in the deeper end of the designated swimming area of the lake, which only went down to around 14 feet, but you could barely see anything. The bottom was a cold and dark abyss. Underwater plants gripped against my calves as I searched the depths. Eventually, I had to return to the surface, and Logan sent us back down again to search after we caught our breath. During my second descent, I was searching by a patch of water weeds when a pale hand brushed against my face. I saw the face next. It was dark, but I could tell that it was a girl with long hair that fanned around her, like she was under static electricity. I gasped, drawing in water. I gripped her torso and began swimming to the surface. She felt swollen, her arms too big, and her temperature was hypothermic. Halfway to the surface, I felt her leg catch on something, and she was pulled back down out of my grip. I turned, watching her open eyes on mine as she descended back into the darkness. My lungs were screaming for air. I had to resurface for oxygen.
I found her! I found her! Come quick!
I shouted, before I dove back down, my hands sweeping through the muddy bottom, but I found nothing but muck, even as the other lifeguards joined. 5 minutes later, Logan's whistle rang out again, calling us back to the dock.
Listen up. The missing camper has been found in the restroom. Ed and Ted must have let him slip past. Both of them will be spending tonight scrubbing the dock.
He paused, and I felt the other lifeguard's gaze fall on me.
You're all free to go, except for you, Mike. I want a word.
The others trudged away, looking back at us over their shoulders. Logan focused on me.
I don't know what the hell that was about, but you could have got someone killed. The next time you try something like this, you're out of here.
But there was someone down there.
I don't believe in ghosts, Mike. And we scoured that water. Now get out of my sight! You're off waterfront!
Word spread around camp about what happened. I could tell many of them detested me, and none believed my side of the story. So I quit the next week, and pushed the incident to the back of my mind, though it would resurface in my dreams. That happened in late June of 1994, 20 years later, which was 11 years ago from now. I read a news article that was titled, Human Remains Found at Camp Valley Way. Due to reservations, the lake was drained, revealing a collection of bones at the deepest region. Several femurs were found attached to anchors with rope. It is estimated that the remains belonged to 19 victims between the ages of 10 and 13 years old. After much investigation, the state police discovered the source of the bodies. 10 years prior to this discovery, the Clarkstown Orphanage was shut down for embezzling state funds. Each summer, the children spent a week at the camp and would be adopted by local families. However, after reviewing the records, it was discovered that these adoptions were never official, and they were disposed of in the lake at an area that was too deep for the campers to normally enter, except for one that drifted near the swimming area due to a corroded rope. It is believed that the orphanage appropriated these children long after their death to extort more money from the state. A lot of the people involved in this conspiracy have been incarcerated, but they didn't get everyone. And there are still many unanswered questions.
I've been an avid fisherman for over 6 years now, and have worked at several different companies as a commercial fisherman, catching snapper, dolphin, whatever is biting and paying, I guess. I was 26 when this happened. I attended grad school in marine biology and had been granted a week off for our spring break. Many graduate programs don't typically offer spring break for students, but I guess I was lucky. During my trip, a buddy and I decided to take a fishing trip off the coast of Hawaii to find the many different species of fish, primarily the ones that were native to the Pacific. We had rented this fishing boat for a few days so we could have a better chance of getting a decent catch. One night during our stay, my friend and I decided to take the boat out at around 1 a.m. to catch a specific type of fish in the area. This fish was semi-nocturnal, and this was the ideal time to catch one. So, him and I are offshore on an average boat with nothing around us but pitch blackness. It's a lot more scary than you think. You had to be there to believe me. One of us is on one side of the boat, while the other is on the opposite, not making a peep, trying to catch this fish. About maybe 20 or so minutes later, we both hear what sounded like humming coming from somewhere around our boat. I asked my friend if he had heard that too, to which he said yes. The humming sounded like it was coming from a person, specifically a woman. I motioned for my friend to turn on the deck light, and to our shock, we found nothing in the water. It made absolutely no sense, as the humming was coming from literally right next to our boat. Seriously, it made me almost piss myself. Every time we heard it from one direction, it would always change to the other direction when we went there. After some time of searching around the boat, the humming stops and my friend yells at me to get over here. I run to the back of the boat, and what I see in the water made my blood run cold. There was a woman who looked to be in her late 20s or early 30s just floating on her back in the water. She did not appear to be alive. However, the odd thing about her was what she was wearing. She wore this dark blue dress that was way too small for her. She wasn't wearing any shoes, but she had on a necklace and a single ring. We both stare at each other in disbelief, thinking if we had just witnessed the aftermath of a murder. My friend and I go inside the boat, attempting to radio the Coast Guard or anyone from shore. We were unable to reach someone, and after a few more attempts, we went back to go check on her, only to find her gone. It had only been 3 minutes since we last saw her, and even after shining the light in the water, she was nowhere in sight. At that point, we decided to end it there, as we were both absolutely creeped the hell out. Back on land, we agreed to not speak a word about what we had seen. Had we told someone, we'd probably be suspected of bringing her on board with us and dumping her body in the ocean. Obviously, we didn't do that, but people aren't going to believe that we just found her. A few days later, my friend had looked up missing people in Hawaii, specifically Maui. After looking through hundreds of people, we never found the woman we saw, and she has yet to be identified. The thing that creeped us out the most was that we were several miles offshore and found this woman in a long dress. It's like putting a puzzle piece where it doesn't fit. It made no sense. If you live in the Maui area, I emphasize you please contact police if you have any information. This encounter keeps me up at night.